We'll change our focus slightly, or maybe more than slightly, but it's a pleasure to have Rabbi Skobach, who I think is really one of the most, you know, thoughtful speakers and thinkers in our community. He, behind the scenes very much, he deals with issues of missionaries and helping people to deal with that side of problem in our community. But he's really, mentioned, very, very, very thoughtful, a powerful speaker, and it's really a pleasure to have him. He's a graduate of Yeshiva University, and he's been working in Toronto for many, many years, and it's a pleasure for me to consider him a personal friend and a scholar and a mentor, if I can say such about you. Thank you very much. Bakasha, Rabbi Skobach.
Thank you, Rabbi Jay, and good morning to all of you. If you were here last night for the panel discussion, I think we all realized that there were many important ideas that were raised. Okay, and the mic will be lowered. I think that we all recognize that the formula that's required for successfully transmitting our Mesorah to the next generation is incredibly complex. And there's a multitude of factors that go into it. It's clearly something that goes way beyond a Groucho Marxian, just say the magic words, and our children will somehow pick up the ball. Both family dynamics, schools, teachers, community, and a myriad of other factors, from the children's self-esteem to any number of very complicated issues, goes into whether or not children will receive that which we're trying to transmit. Similarly, in the same way, there are incredibly complex and numerous different reasons why children may not ultimately end up embracing the faith of their families. I think it's important to echo something that Rabbi Karapkin said last night, which is that in our complicated world, we can't automatically assume or expect that our kids and students will necessarily desire to be Orthodox. It may have been something that was more assumable generations ago, but I think that in a world where people often feel entitled and an expectation, and it has to be, and it's impossible to be otherwise, the reality is that we can't take that as a given anymore. But that shouldn't deter us from trying. And our goal, obviously, is not just that our children and students will know about Judaism. What we're hoping, ultimately, is that they will buy into Judaism. They will embrace Judaism. The Bali Musar explain that ideas themselves are very weak. Knowing something itself is actually very, very weak. And it doesn't really become significant until we internalize the idea. For example, it's not simply enough to know that it's wrong to steal. Just knowing that it's wrong to steal will probably not prevent people from being unethical. What's critical is that we develop a repulsion, that the idea of taking something that doesn't belong to us should sicken us, should make us sick. We should find the idea repulsive. Because of the demands of my work, I've been encouraged to open up Facebook and Twitter accounts. I can tell you that I've embraced and I've bought into Facebook. I have not yet bought into Twitter, right? I haven't made any kind of real personal investment. I have an account. I might tweet once in a blue moon, but I haven't bought into it. And I think that what we're going to try to understand this morning is what can be offered and presented to help students and children buy into Judaism? When trying to convey that which is compelling about Judaism, I think it's critical to remember that we communicate not so much by what we say, but by who we are. Words probably mean very, very little when it comes to communicating important ideas to children. Judaism ultimately has to be modeled. As they say, it has to be caught much more than taught. I always encourage parents to take their focus off of their children. Don't worry so much about what to do for your children in terms of helping them be Jewish and stay Jewish. Put the emphasis on yourselves. The Hasidic masters would say that if you want to fill a saucer with tea, you have to overflow the cup. And so I want to encourage everyone to think, as I'm sharing with you a number of ideas this morning, that transmitting them is ultimately going to be successful, not so much by teaching these ideas directly, but by modeling them, by living them, by embodying them, and therefore helping to transmit them in the most effective way. Rabbi Soloveitchik once wrote very poignantly that most of all, he said, I learned from my mother that Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the Torah, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, a warmth to the mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting on my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless human being, dry and insensitive. A friend of mine in Florida once helped reframe for his children what it meant, for example, to thank God for our food after we eat. And he used to tell his children, you've got a bench now. He began teaching his children, you get to bench now. And I think that our goal ultimately is how we communicate a Judaism to our children that will be exciting, that will be compelling, that will capture their imaginations, that they will want to wrap their lives around, and where they'll feel not that they got to, but that they get to. What I'm going to try and do in the very short time that we have, and even maybe allow for some questions, is share with you four ideas, and this is not meant to be exhaustive. I think there's much more that could be said. But four ideas in terms of what is there about Yiddishkeit, what is there about Judaism that can be compelling, that a person might feel they can organize their lives around. I think one of the things that we often underestimate or underemphasize are the truth claims of Judaism. Human beings have an innate sensitivity, an inbuilt sensitivity for that which is true and that which is real. We're drawn to it. And at the same time, we're very turned off by anything that doesn't have the ring of truth to it. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in his Kuzari, 1,000 years ago, focused on some of the compelling historical truth claims for Judaism. And in our generation, Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb in Jerusalem also spent a tremendous amount of time helping Jews in our generation understand the compelling nature of the truth claims of Judaism. As Rabbi Jay mentioned, I spend a lot of my time dealing with Jews who've embraced Christianity. And Christians spend a tremendous amount of energy promoting their faith and basing it upon the alleged historical truths of Christianity. I was at Tyndale Bible College last week, an evangelical Christian school here in Toronto, giving a lecture on the basics of Judaism. And one of the questions that always comes up when I'm there is, why don't Jews believe that Jesus was the Messiah? And I basically give them a fairly strong 5 minutes worth of why Jews reject the messianic claims of Jesus. And usually they shoot back to me, but Rabbi, what about all the miracles that he did? And for Christians, there's a tremendous investment in terms of the truth of what they believe on the story of the resurrection of Jesus. And I often find this tremendously strange, because it doesn't take a lot of research and thinking to basically puncture the credibility of these stories. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus and for the miracles that he allegedly performed is so flimsy that by comparison, it makes the Jewish claims to historical truth seem like a slam dunk. We all know that Moshe Rabbeinu did not come down from Har Sinai and simply claim that a Kadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him. You know, I have a friend in Baltimore who was once very actively involved with a Jews for Jesus synagogue. And he told me that one day he was very shaken up because a young woman came to him and said, "Larry, the Lord came to me last night and spoke unto me and revealed to me that we're to be married." And Larry was very upset because he believed in God and he believed that God communicates to people, and he was not at all interested in this young woman. So he went to his pastor, and his pastor very wisely said to him, "Larry, when the Lord speaks unto you about marrying this woman, then we'll talk about it." It's very easy for her to make the claim that this is what God told her. We all know that in our narrative, it wasn't simply that Moses claimed to have heard from God at Har Sinai. We know that every single Jew who left Egypt, approximately 2 to 3 million people, heard God speak to Moses at Mount Sinai. Incredibly, the Torah predicts that no other people in the history of the world will ever make such a claim. No other people will ever claim that they have received a national revelation. Every single religion in the world begins with a private revelation. Someone claims to have heard from God. And the reason the Torah is able to make this bold prediction that no one else will ever make the claim that they had a national revelation is you cannot fabricate a national revelation. You cannot make it up. It's interesting that both Christianity and Islam accept our basic historical narrative. Our story about the revelation at Mount Sinai is so solidly based in history that our two daughter religions and ultimately competing religions totally accept this basic foundation of Judaism. My father told me that when he was in a DP camp after the war in Europe, he had to have some documents notarized. The only place that would do it was a Catholic monastery not far from his DP camp. He came with his documents, knocked on the big wooden door. A priest came out with his whole outfit and the sash. And the priest saw my father and he hit the ground. He fell on the floor. And looking up with tears in his eyes, he said to my father, "Do you know who you are?" My father thought this guy was crazy. He said, "You're from the people who stood at Mount Sinai 3,000 years ago. And God spoke to your people on the desert floor." Here's how a Christian looks at a Jew as a part of the people that actually heard God speak at Mount Sinai. The Ramban explains in this week's Parsha, in Parsha's Bo, that this is precisely why as Jews we're so obsessed with Pesach. We're so obsessed with thinking about Passover, with reliving Passover. It comes up so often, not just on Pesach. Almost every day we as Jews focus on Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Ramban says basically that it's so critical for us because this was a moment in time when our people became electrically aware of God's presence. The historical events that we went through, when God said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "The Jewish people want to know who I am? What is God's name? I will be what I will be." God says to Moses, "The Jewish people will experience me on the stage of history. You want to understand me? You'll experience me. You'll see." So going through the Yetzias Mitzrayim with all the incredible supernatural plagues with which Woody Allen once said you can't do with some cheap gizmo from Corvettes. And finally they cross the Red Sea where the Jews have a vision of God, as the Chazal say, that was clearer than Yechezkel ben Buzi, the prophet. We went through such incredibly dramatic supernatural events that we came to Har Sinai to hear God's voice speaking to us didn't really take away our Bechira. That's how clear it was to us that there was a God that runs the world and controls nature. And so we as Jews are obsessed with never forgetting this moment in our history. That's why the Torah says, and we say it at least in Nusach Sfard every Shabbat when we take out the Torah, Ata Harei Saladas. God showed us that we should know that He is God and there is none else. Aside from, again, I'm doing this in bullet form, we don't have a lot of time to focus on any of these things in great depth, but aside from going through the Kuzari and Rabbi David Gottlieb's material on the historical veracity of something like Ma'amar Har Sinai, I recommend that you take a look and think about Eish HaTorah's seven wonders of Jewish history. A look at how the Torah speaks about things that are so almost counterintuitive, thousands of years ahead of time, and yet incredibly all come true. I want to make a caveat. I don't want to give the impression that we should teach these as proofs of Judaism. I'm very wary of the word proof because it puts people on the defensive and it can sound arrogant. But I think the idea that we have as Jews a foundation for Yiddishkeit, for our beliefs, that are not myths and fairy tales that we simply have to believe in as blind faith. But I believe there are very compelling, substantive reasons why a Jew can feel comfortable embracing Judaism. During last night's panel discussion, Leah mentioned the importance of cultivating a personal relationship with God. In my experience, this is just about the most important piece of the puzzle, and one, unfortunately, that I believe our community seems to have totally gotten away from, one where we really have seemed to have dropped the ball. In the spring 2012 issue of Klal Perspectives, which I highly recommend that you all read, an entire issue of this journal devoted to the issue of why so many Orthodox Jews seem to have little or no connection to God in their lives whatsoever. We seem to work very hard at nurturing religiously observant Jews, but not so well at nurturing spiritual Jews. A wise person once said that the difference between religion and spirituality is like the difference between reading the menu and eating the meal. No one ever gets filled up or nourished by simply reading the menu. Rabbi Victor Miller used to observe that religious Jews will religiously recite the Shema twice a day. We read the menu. We say the Shema. V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha. You should love the Lord your God. And Rabbi Miller said, fine, we've read the words, we've read the menu, we're religious. But Rabbi Miller asked the question, how many people spend any time during the day thinking about loving God, or trying to love God, or wondering, what do I do if I don't feel the love? But it's not enough simply to read the menu. What makes it spiritual is to actually experience it. Over the past 30 years, I've met hundreds of Jewish people, hundreds, if not into the thousands, who have become born-again Christians. And I will tell you that virtually 100% of them have the same exact trajectory. Growing up with various levels of Jewish observance, they all report that the thing that was missing for them in their Jewish upbringing was any focus on having a personal relationship with God, and this is precisely what they found in the church. Mindy Ribner, who was a friend of mine from New York, spoke here once at Torah in Motion. In her first book, she wrote the following. I went to my Hillel rabbi, hoping that I would find someone to talk to me about God and the meaning of life. He told me not to think so much and to take up swimming. I didn't take up swimming, but a guru from India came to our university the next day, and he spoke about God. Avram Davis, who wrote a wonderful book called The Way of Flame, wrote that I had great trouble finding teachers in the Jewish community who spoke to the spiritual nature of my concerns. I would ask my questions, and as often as not, be steered in the direction of ancient writings, ancient words. These leaders seemed to be saying to me, let the ancient writings of these holy but dead individuals guide you. I myself have no knowledge of what the hell you're talking about. But I didn't need more books, he writes. I was looking for the power of the tradition. I needed not the description of the embrace of God, but the actual embrace itself. That was the desire, he writes, that led me to India. For so many of us, God too often gets lost in the shuffle. Even though connecting with Hashem is the ultimate and absolute bottom line of Yiddishkeit. Our Torah begins by talking about the creation of man and women. And the Torah says that God tells us, every man should therefore leave his mother and father and cleave unto his wife. Devak be'ishto. You know, in modern Hebrew, the word devek means glue. It's a very, very strong word. And later in the Torah, the Bible very daringly uses the exact same word when describing what is supposed to be our relationship with Hashem. The Bible speaks, the Torah speaks about devekut, of attaching ourselves to God, of cleaving to God, of getting that intimately close with God. The word mitzvah, as we know, doesn't simply mean a commandment. Do this and don't do that. We know that etymologically the word mitzvah is related to the word for binder or connector. Every mitzvah is there for the purpose of connecting us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we say Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav, it's not just that you have sanctified us with his commandments. What does that word mean anyway? Or God has made us holy with his commandments. But we know that it has the meaning as well that God has wedded us with his commandments. He's married us with his mitzvot. God has become involved in a relationship with us through these connectors, these binders. The Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, and many, many others have explained that just like a parent ultimately desires for their child's ultimate fulfillment, ultimate gratification, ultimate pleasure, if you scratch any parent, that's what they want for their children. And we know that as Jews, we learn so much about our relationship with God from our relationship with our parents. That's why Kabed es Avicha v'Simecha appears on the first five of the Luchos that describe our relationship with Hashem. And so if we understand what our parents, our fleshly parents want for us, our terrestrial parents want for us, Hashem wants nothing less. Ramchal explains that Hashem put us in this world to basically have ultimate fulfillment, ultimate pleasure, ultimate gratification. And just as we know we live in a world where there are so many incredible pleasures, so many incredibly beautiful things, we know that there's a source to all of these pleasures. If we are blown away by a sunset, we can get to know the Tzur Olamim, the artist behind that sunset. If you like dark chocolate or the smile of a baby, you can get to know what is the force and power behind all of the beauty and wonder and pleasure in this world. As a high school student, I had the opportunity during a high school work study project to work at Nabisco, doing product research and quality control testing. But I had the ability, when I was working at Nabisco, to actually eat Fig Newtons off the assembly line. Now, if you like Fig Newtons, usually you're getting them 10, 15 months old in a sealed bag that's been on the store shelf. But I loved Fig Newtons. And to get to eat one from the factory, hot off the assembly line, nothing like it. So Ramchal explains to us that we have the potential to have that much pleasure in the world by connecting ourselves to the source of all pleasure. The Gemara says very famously in several places about the Jewish people, "Afilu reikanim shebahem maleim mitzvot kerimon." Even the emptiest Jews can be as full of mitzvot as a pomegranate. And it's very strange, if a person has that many mitzvot, we know that every pomegranate has exactly 613 seeds. So how can it be that you call such a person a rake, someone that's empty if they're so full of commandments? In the Sefer Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, Rav Schwartz explains, based upon a teaching of Rav David Pavarsky, that what the Gemara is saying here is very profound. When you eat almost any other fruit, a banana, an apple, a pear, when you bite into it, it's all apple, it's all pear, it's all apple kite, it's all bananadom. But you eat a pomegranate, it's just separate seeds, detached. They're not connected to each other. And just like the Navi we read on Parsha Shmos, Yeshayahu says that to the Jewish people, unfortunately, the Torah and the mitzvot became tzavla tzav, and kavla kavit, kavla kavit, zersham, and zersham. It's just a bunch of do's and don'ts. And if that's how we see the Torah, as just a book of do's and don'ts, when it's not connected by anything, that's the problem with the rimon, the pomegranate. There's nothing that connects those separate seeds. So if our performance of Judaism, if our embrace of Torah, is basically just performing do's and don'ts, and there's no overarching principle that connects everything, which is the idea that every single one of these commandments is a way of connecting ourselves to Hashem, our Judaism can be very empty indeed. I was very taken recently by reading a brochure by a wonderful organization, Project Inspired. We have it here in Toronto. And they had a little report written by a fellow from Borough Park, a Hasidish Jew from Borough Park, who said that he was challenged by people he met to explain about Judaism. He wasn't able to explain Judaism. He says he went to a Project Inspired weekend, a convention. And he says he was so blown away to discover that everything we do in Judaism is in order to have a relationship with God. And I cried when I read this. Here's an adult person, a man probably in his 30s or 40s, a Hasidic Jew from Borough Park, never knew that Judaism was about having a relationship with Hashem. You know, they tell a story about a young man in a Lithuanian yeshiva, hundreds of years ago. And he says to his Rebbe one day, Rebbe, I heard in Meserich, the seat of the Hasidic movement. In Meserich, he said, I heard there's a fire burning. And the Rosh Yeshiva said, Meserich, what do you need to go to Meserich? You're here in a yeshiva, we learn Gemara all day, we daven, what else is there? And the young man ran away to Meserich. He stayed there for 3 years. He came back, and his Rebbe sees him, and his Rebbe says, oh, look who's here, the big shot from Meserich. What did you learn when you were Meserich? And the young boy says, Rebbe, in Meserich, I learned how to read minds. And the Rebbe says, really? You can read minds? What am I thinking right now? And the boy says, Rebbe, I know that you're meditating on the verse in the Bible, Shivisi Hashem Negi Samid. I put God's presence before me at all times. And the Rebbe said, I wasn't thinking about that. And the boy said, that's why I ran away to Meserich. The truth is, it may not be so easy for us to mass produce Devekus Jews, because often we ourselves don't feel it. But I think that what we can nurture is a generation of Mevakshei Hashem, a generation of people who seek Hashem, who desire to have this closeness. We may not be able to turn it on and off like a light switch, but to be people who at least want it, who desire it, is something that we can aim for. You know, the Gemara says to us that when we go to the next world, there's going to be a final exam. The Gemara says that on the final exam, and we're told in advance what to prepare for. The Gemara says in one version that the first question we're going to be asked is, Nasata v'natata be'emuna, which is usually translated, did you deal honestly and fairly in your business dealings? But the Holy Tzanzer Rebbe explained it differently. He said, Nasata v'natata be'emuna. Did you do business with your emuna? And he explained that when we have money, no one wants to have their money sit there and just be doing nothing. People want to grow their money. They want $1,000 to become more than $1,000. So what do people do with their money? They go to speak to financial advisors, they read the investment reports, and they go and analyze the stock market. But people put a tremendous amount of effort and energy into growing their money. He says, the first question we're going to be asked is, did you make this kind of effort with your emunah? Did you try to grow your faith, to become deeper in your faith? Nasata v'natata be'emunah. I want to again reemphasize, it's hard to communicate this as a parent. It's hard to communicate this as a teacher when it's an ideal that may not have been embraced by our community. It's one thing to learn an ideal in Judaism. It's one thing to learn this beautiful idea of getting close to Hashem and how everything in Torah is part of having a relationship with Hashem, and your parents could model it, and your parents could teach it, and you may even have an inspired teacher in school that teaches it to you. But if we walk into our shuls and we don't see a community that takes it seriously, we see, as Rabbi Soloveitchik says, a community that would rather have davened than would rather daven. It's not going to have any reality. It's an idea that's not backed up by the world we're living in. And I really pray that we have the ability not just to be able to become inspired parents and inspired day school teachers, but that we're able to actually produce a community where our students can actually see these ideals being lived and taken seriously by the people they're surrounded by. Because if there's an incongruity between what students learn and what they experience, it becomes a very difficult proposition. There's a young woman who grew up very close to me in New Jersey. I was living in Fairlawn. She was in Cherry Hill. We're almost the same age. Many of you know her. Sarah Yocheved Rigler spent about 17 years after university on a Hindu ashram. And when she returned to Judaism, she was asked in an interview, what was missing for you growing up Jewishly? What wasn't there when you were growing up Jewishly? And she said two words, two very simple words. One I've just spoken about. She said, for me, what was missing was God. In the Judaism I grew up with, no one spoke about getting close to God. No one spoke about feeling the presence of God in their lives. No one spoke about having a relationship with God. It was just a word. It wasn't real. But she said something else that was missing. She said what was missing from her growing up Jewishly was any focus on growth. She never understood how anything that she experienced or learned about in Judaism had anything to do with personal transformation. The Torah begins very strangely by saying, Na'aseh Adam Betzalmenu. God just created a whole world, and he finally says, when he creates human beings, let us make man. And the $64,000 question is, who is God speaking to? Some of the commentaries say God was consulting with the angels. Other commentaries say that God was speaking in the royal we, like the Queen of England might say, what shall we now do? But the Baal Shem Tov explained very beautifully that God was speaking to every human being who will ever live. Because God is basically saying here that he cannot create a human being. Everything else God could create unilaterally. God could say, let there be dogs. God could say, let there be trees. God could say, let there be stars. But God is saying, I cannot say, let there be man. Because God is basically saying, I can only give you the raw ingredients. I can give you a body and a soul, but what you become is a function of what you do with those raw ingredients. So God is speaking to every human being who will ever live, and God is saying, let us make a mensch. Let us. God is saying, you and I will create you. God cannot make us who we are. When people ask me, what is your denomination? I say, under constructionism. That's what we are as human beings. Rabbi David Aaron in Jerusalem, who came from Toronto, calls us human becomings, not human beings. Because that's what human life is all about. Our life is here to build something. We're here to make something of ourselves. We're here on a building project. Chazal says something very daring. And Chazal wasn't often given to this kind of statement, which really almost goes over the top. Chazal say, Lo nitna Torah ella. That phrase is very strong. Lo nitna Torah ella. The Torah was only given kedei letzaref b'hem es habrios, in order to refine us, to perfect us, to change us. That's a big statement. The whole purpose for the Torah is basically to help us grow. The Vilna Gaon said that we were put into this world to change and work on our midot. And he said if a human being goes through life and doesn't work on their character traits, they basically have wasted their entire life. I always ask students to think about what children look like between the ages of 0 and 10. A zero zygote, a 10-year-old child. And think about, does any change take place during those 10 years? During the ages from 0 to 10, you notice any differences, any development, any changes? It's incredibly dramatic what happens in those 10 years. And think about the next decade, a 10-year-old child to a 20-year-old adult. 10-year-old, a little kid talking back to their parents, a 20-year-old could even be married. So the change and development and growth that takes place during those two first decades is mind-blowing. But look at people, God forbid, between 20 and 30, 30 and 40, 40 and 50, 50 and 60, 60 and 70, 70 and 80. And ask yourself, what really happens during those decades? Any serious change and development? I'm not talking about a little bit more gray, a little less hair, a little bit more weight. But what really changes about people over those decades? You know, it's one thing to look back on a Rosh Hashanah and ask ourselves, how am I different than last year? But think about a whole decade, 10 years, and to ask ourselves, have I really changed much in those 10 years? It's a frightening question. And the Torah was given in order to help us become people who are more patient and have less issues with anger, to be people who have more humility and less arrogance, to be people who are more sensitive to others, to people that have more gratitude. I'll never forget, I read a story. I don't usually read obituaries, but I happened to read an obituary in Hamodia once about a 20-year-old young man that passed away. And they said that after he passed away, they found in his room notebooks that he kept. For years, he kept notebooks where every single day he wrote down everything he had to be grateful for. He was a young man that worked on the midah of gratitude, of hakarat hatov, which is really what it's all about being a Jew. A Yehudi is someone that is someone who's thankful to Hashem. And yet it's something which we could easily spend our whole lives not thinking one day about. About overcoming laziness. About developing more inner peace. There are so many aspects to personal growth that so many people have no clue that Judaism says one word about. So for a person to understand that Judaism is a technology for us to grow and to transform ourselves is an incredibly empowering thing. If you want an angle about Judaism in which you could actually totally wrap your life around, it's this project of building who we are as human beings. It's similar to building a relationship with Hashem. We all know that building things is incredibly empowering. If you remember the movie, The Bridge Over the River Kwai, right? The British soldiers, the prisoners of war, were totally transformed by building this bridge for the Japanese tormentors. And at the end of the film, when their own troops came to blow up the bridge because it was the bridge for the wrong team, these people didn't want it being destroyed. This is what we worked on. And we know that's how Paro tortured the Jewish people. He made us build these cities of Pitom and Ramses in areas that were prone to earthquakes. Because the most devastating thing is to work and not mean anything. So we have a life where we can work and actually produce a masterpiece. That's why, by the way, in Perek Shira, you can get a picture edition today of Perek Shira, where there's a song of everything in the world that was created, and the song that it sings, there's no human being in Perek Shira. You won't find a person in Perek Shira. Because God can't write your song. Every human being has to write their own song. And so the Torah has incredible wisdom and incredible technology to help us grow as human beings. And we have people today in our generation, like Rabbi Leib Kellerman from Jerusalem, or Alan Marinis, originally from Toronto, now in Vancouver, who've dedicated their lives to helping people understand the incredible power of the Torah to help us grow as human beings. I've discussed three issues so far. One, the idea of trying to connect with the idea that Judaism is real. It's true. And to think about the truth claims of Judaism. To think about the idea that we're building relationships with Hashem and we're building our own lives. I want to speak about one more issue before I take questions. When I was a teenager, I was extremely alienated from Judaism. I was a child of the 60s and a very, very idealistic young person. And if you would have asked me as a young person what my greatest desire was, I would have answered like any Miss America contestant, and I would have said, world peace. And that was really my dream, and that was what I was focused on. And I was very quickly drawn into the anti-war movement at the time that was dealing with the conflicts in Vietnam and Cambodia. And I felt back then that religions were part of the problem, that religions divided people and caused much of the strife and conflict in our world. I attended Northwestern University near Chicago, and fellow students challenged me. And they said, you know, Skobach, for someone that hates Judaism so much, it's funny to us that you seem to know very little about it. And wouldn't it make sense, before you rejected it forever, to first find out what Judaism is? And thank God, even though I had an open mind, all of my brains had not yet fallen out. And I decided that their challenge was real, and that it would make sense for me maybe to first explore what I felt so strongly against. And so I left Northwestern University. I attended a special program at Yeshiva University they had for wayward Jews, Jews that had no Jewish background. I was very blessed and fortunate to have teachers like Rabbi Benjamin Blech, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Rabbi Morris Besdin. And I learned for the first time in my life, and I didn't grow up as a Jew in Montana. I grew up as a Jew in New York, and I went to Hebrew school. But I learned for the first time in my life that Judaism has a vision of a world mission to change the world and make the world a better place. Judaism has a utopian vision. And I had never been exposed to this idea. I grew up totally ignorant of the idea that Judaism had a sense of mission to change the world, that as Jews we are radical revolutionaries. And we all know that everyone is idealistic, but Jews seem to be hardwired for idealism. And Jews for the last thousands of years have sacrificed with this idea that we are here to make the world a better place. God says to Abraham at the very beginning of our story, through you, through your family, through your nation, all the peoples of the world we've blessed. God says to us right before we receive the Torah at Mount Sinai, you're to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. We are to be priests, which are teachers of the world. The Torah tells us was of the Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations. Of course, there was tremendous dissonance for me when I encountered religious Jews who didn't embody these ideals. When I encountered religious Jews who expressed ideas that were racist or ideas that were derisive of non-Jews. And it was a tremendous struggle for me to embrace this idea that Judaism is here to make the world a better place, and that I can play a role in making the world a better place, and my life can make a difference. For me, these are incredibly empowering ideas. And I've met many, many people whose embrace of Judaism is strongly reinforced by the idea that as a Jew, I'm part of something which is larger than myself. I'm embracing a movement to change this world and make the world a better place. And so when I met Jewish people who seemed to be expressing values and ideas and words that were so counter to this, it did really shake me up. It was difficult. And yet, as disappointed as I was, I came to the conclusion that these were distortions of Judaism and not true expressions of Judaism. And so I persisted undeterred. If you want to look at a group in the Jewish community today that has succeeded in instilling a sense of mission in their children, and I go to many, many Jewish schools, you'll see this in Chabad schools. Kids who grow up in Chabad families are raised, it's in their mother's milk, and it's basically, it's absorbed into their bloodstream and into their mental faculties and into their psyche, that I am part of a movement that's going to make the world better, specifically through making the Jewish people better. But it's incredible how empowering it is to see Chabad kids with this sense of mission. They buy into it. They're empowered by it. They're transformed by it. And I'll tell you, it is very inspiring to see kids like this. Teenagers who often can be very, very self-centered, who are just because of their upbringing transformed into idealistic people who want to give, they want to serve, they want to help. And we all know that Mashiach is not just for Chabad. Mashiach is not just about a person. Mashiach is about this Jewish vision of a transformed utopian world, a better place. And so I believe that something like Zionism, that one of the great aspects of Zionism was not simply to create this amazing startup nation in the Middle East that exports high-tech products. The idea of Zionism for us as the Jewish people was our way of building a model society of justice and of compassion where we can be a light unto the nations. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah. That's supposed to be the export of Eretz Yisrael. And so there's an extremely utopian element to this tie that we have to Eretz Yisrael and to Zionism. They tell a story of someone that had a store on a strip mall. And in the strip mall, there were three stores that each basically sold the same kind of products. And one day, the fellow in the middle looks to his right, and the store on the right has put up a huge sign that says, Giant Clearance Sale. He looks on the left-hand side of his store, and there's an even bigger sign by his other competitor that says, Blowout Low Prices. And this poor guy in the middle, Nebuch, he feels that they're going to kill him. They're going to drive him out of business. And a friend says, all you need to do is to put up a big sign on your store that says, Main Entrance. That's our challenge. Our challenge is, in a world where there are so many incredibly competing ideas, in a world where there are so many winds that are pulling at our children, our students, how do we make Judaism feel like the main entrance? How do we present and convey and live and model a Judaism that's compelling? Where someone could say, you know what, there's something here that I could bite into, that I could wrap my life around, that I can engage with. Something that excites my imagination, my passion, something that stimulates me. And I believe, again, there are many, many more things on the menu I didn't talk about today. But I believe the four aspects that I mentioned could be part of the menu for us to think about in terms of what we might transmit to our students to help make for them Judaism the main entrance. I want to thank you all so much for your attentiveness, and I think we have some time for questions if there are any questions. Let's not see the same hands every week. You have to step up to the mic.
Just a quick question. Intrigued with your comments with regards to having a relationship with God and so forth. But what would you say to people that, for example, you know, people have this belief that, you know, if you play by the rules, you know, because this concept of reward and punishment in Judaism, right? You see that in Shema and so forth. But if people experience a great loss, for example, right, and they question God, how could God do this to me? What would be your response to that?
I'm very tempted to take Rabbi Horowitz's approach to this question and say, gotta go. No, to be fair, you know, the question of theodicy of, you know, why bad things happen to good people and why tragedies happen, it's not really reasonable to think I'm going to address it in 1 minute, because it deserves an entire session and more. It could be a Yom Iyun. So I would love to be able to give you a snappy answer to your question, but I don't have a snappy answer. The question is serious enough and important enough that it deserves a serious answer, which it's not really feasible just on 1 foot. Okay. Yes.
Hello. So as a student, I'm kind of upset that there are not many more students here who can speak for themselves about what they're not finding compelling about Judaism. But I found your speech to be geared towards people who are actively searching for God, people who turn away from Judaism and try and find God in different ways. But the theme of last night, it's what about people who are not searching for God. And the very things that you mentioned that would help compel people, like, I don't know, Zionism, Messianism, connecting to God, those are the very things that are alienating many of our students. And if God is the bottom line of Judaism, are these people who don't see God as important anymore a complete lost cause? Or is there something else about Judaism that can be compelling to them?
I don't know if my comments were specifically directed to people or about people who themselves are seeking God. Again, I guess, in terms of my most conscious audience was really thinking about parents and teachers. And parents are raising children who are not necessarily seeking anything, right? But my concern is, what is being communicated to children growing up? They may not be seeking God. They may be a little bit young for that, to be intellectual seekers. But the question is, are they growing up in homes where that is a important value that's being lived? My assumption is that families that are able to lovingly, creatively, passionately live this kind of relationship with God have a very good chance of communicating that to their children. I mean, the reality is, and we all know this, children tend to grow up accepting, they tend to, what is valued by their parents. It's not a given, as I said before, and parents can't assume that because they love something, their children are going to love it. But the focus of my comments were, what do parents do who are hoping their children will embrace Judaism? I personally think that a Judaism that focuses on only externals, right, without getting to what's behind all those externals, right? And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not presenting all of the ways of explaining Torah observance. There are different angles. This is just one of them. But I think that a family that is able to live and model a life, not just of commitment to following the rules, but there's a goal, there's a purpose, there's a, not just a goal and a purpose, but a beautiful purpose, and a big purpose, meaning the idea that we have the ability to have a relationship with the Creator, it's a pretty big idea. And children, I think, can relate to it, of developing a relationship with God. So it may not just be people that are seeking God. I think that on some level, maybe an assumption that I'm making is that as human beings, by nature, we are spiritual, that we're not just a body, but we're a body and a soul. So I'm making this assumption based upon my experience with people that I work with, that people desire some spiritual outlet in their lives. I think it was the psychoanalyst or the psychologist Carl Gustav Jung who said that in his more than 30 years of psychoanalysis, the one thing that every single patient he had in common was that there was a spiritual lack or deficiency in their lives. So I think that it's helpful for us as Jews to make sure that we don't raise children who are growing up where they feel spiritually devoid. You asked much more than that, but I'm not sure I can answer much more than that. Again, your question is a wonderful question, a series of questions, and it really deserves, again, more than a 2 or 3 minute response. So what I would say is, and it's not a cop-out, please get in touch with me. Facebook, email, phone, person. And it's a question, it's a conversation I'd be very happy to have. Okay. Acharon Chaviv.
Yeah, for the last couple of weeks, I know you've seen me very often, and we're good friends behind the scenes. My question is related to a little bit about your own travels. out west recently and connecting it to myself. For those who don't know me, I grew up out west in Victoria, British Columbia, a small community of one shul. Not a lot of support, per se. One thing that I can say for my class of bar mitzvah boys and girls, bat mitzvah girls, are that there was not a lot of retention. The classic story of the bar mitzvah, they all come over and there are a bunch of doves and they hover and then they fly away the following year and they're no longer there. It's very much my experience growing up. Of my class, I can only think of maybe one or two Shomer Shabbos real Jews who are actively involved in our Yiddishkeit. For those of us who come from a smaller community, how do you address your approach of yes, lovingness and everything else, but unless in a place where there's not as many services as Toronto, a mega box of beautiful resources like Torah and Moshe and other such organizations, how do you respond in a smaller community where there's much less of a support?
Hi. Okay. Two words. What God said to Abraham, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. Now, the truth is that I did just get back from Victoria. There are now two shuls in Victoria. There's an Eshet Torah and there's a Chabad. And so actually, there is the ability for people to connect with inspired teachers there and actually nice, wonderful communities. And in many ways, people say there are advantages to being in a small community. I think there are more advantages to being in a bigger community with more resources, but I don't think it's impossible for a person to grow up in a place like Victoria and not connect Jewishly.
Sorry, Rabbi, not to break your flow, but also within a national context, not all, obviously, like within a nationhood of Yiddish, of Klal Yisrael in a smaller community, how would you respond?
You know, the story I was told when I went out west was that no one came here for the Judaism, right? So, you know, it's always a function of what families desire, right? People who from whom Judaism is a priority will try to live in a community where they have the services and resources that are going to help nurture their own Judaism and the Judaism of their kids, right? It's that which is important to them. And people often will go to places and Judaism is not on top of the list. So they might find themselves, you know, out west, so to speak, or in a smaller community. And if it becomes important to their Jewishness, or if someone just awakens Jewishly, you know, how do they make the most of their circumstances? I'll say that today the game changer is very simple. We have on the internet a website now for a number of years, and I'll tell you that I'm contacted literally every day by dozens of people who live in the most remote part of the world. And so in many ways, our world has become a much smaller world today. And a person could theoretically, it's not what I recommend, but a person theoretically today, if they have access to be online, you have a kosher tube, right? And you have Na'aleh, and you have H.com and Chabad.org. You have enough material just on the internet to keep you busy for several lifetimes. And a lot of it is of quite good quality. Quite good quality. If you like learning Daf Yomi now, there are hundreds of Daf Yomi Shiurim, some of them quite good, just online. So being out west or somewhere remote doesn't mean the end of your Judaism. In fact, there was a website I remember seeing years ago called Rural Frum. I can't say it very easily, but Rural Frum. And these are people that were living out in the sticks, and somehow they were developing an online community. And again, so people have to make the best of the situations they're in. I think that many places in Canada, which seem remote, have some Jewish resources. I was just with my wife this year a few times in Calgary. Who would think that a Calgary can become, you know, a city which is strong Jewishly? It's becoming an increasingly strong Jewish community. It's one of the only cities in Canada that's growing Jewishly. They happen to have just a blessing from Hashem, a first-class Rav that moved there, a senior Rav that usually doesn't move out to a place like Calgary, that's transforming the city. There's a Kollel in Calgary, right? There are teachers, there are resources there. And so there's the ability to grow Jewishly. It certainly is possible. Again, it's not easy, but maybe there are some benefits to having a difficult life, right? More challenges to overcome. It requires more of a desire, a cheshek, to actually pursue it. But so thank you for the question, Rabbi Jay. I'm out of here.